Welcome to Insight Intercom, an occasional podcast on startups, product management, and design. In this show, Intercom co-founder Des Trainer talks to product designer Peter Mierholtz.
Today I'm joined by Peter Mierholtz. Peter is Senior Director of Product Experience at Jawbone, and before that was a founder of Adaptive Path. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. So we're going to talk a bit about product management. We both have opinions in this, and we've talked about it before. So one thing I'm interested in, the role has become so popular lately, and whenever you Google it, you get all the sort of older papers, and the most common phrase we hear is the product manager is the mini CEO. What's your take on that?
A friend of mine, Jonathan Corman, just tweeted about this very topic and said that if you believe the product manager is a mini CEO, you know neither what CEOs do nor what product managers do. And that's probably kind of how I feel about it, right? A CEO is, you know, the person most responsible for the success and health of an entire organization. Primarily financial health of an organization. Product managers trying to ship product. Some product managers have business case responsibilities, right? Business, you know, they're responsible for some form of P&L that suggests their success, but that is not CEO behavior, and it's also not true of all product managers. It kind of depends on where that. How that product fits within other products within an organization. So, I don't know if I necessarily have a definition of a product manager, just because I think there are a number of different ways to tackle it, and it feels to me like it's a field, a practice, a role that is maturing. But I would definitely not refer to it as the CEO of a product.
Right. That certainly rhymes with my experience. I think there is definitely a blurry definition that I think that's kind of caused by, it kind of depends on who else is on the team and what are the roles are fleshed out. Like if you have a really like mature senior experienced designer and like a really great like say like advanced sort of mature engineer who like both of whom have shipped a lot of software before, to introduce this third person as a mini CEO makes no sense.
Right.
Conversely, if you've got like somebody who's the only consistent thing, like as in they've contracted in design and they've contracted in engineering, sure, call yourself the CEO, but it's
right,
you know, call yourself
right,
whatever.
Right. No, it makes sense.
Do you think a design background is advantageous, necessary, optional for a product manager?
I would say it's advantageous and optional. I just spoke about this. I went over to Tradecraft, which is kind of a school here in San Francisco, similar to General Assembly, where people with like one professional background shift into a digital product professional background because that's where the jobs are. And talked a little bit about this there in that there's, I think there's an assumption that there is a way to do product management. So product management has become kind of this singular definition, unlike designer, right? You have visual designers and product designers and interaction designers and UX designers and engineers. You might have, you know, whether it's the technology they're working on, iOS or web, the kind of stack, the kind of language, you recognize flavors, but product manager is always product manager. And I think that speaks to its immaturity because kind of depending on the nature of the product or the part of the product that you're working on, you might have something that's more consumer facing, you might have something that's more technical, you might have something that's more of an analytics challenge, yeah, whatever it is. And so you want to find product managers who can speak, who can address whatever that product need is or feature need is. Frankly, a lot of product managers work at the level of feature as opposed to product.
Yeah.
At least that was my experience at Groupon. And so if you're doing consumer-facing product, that is where it is most definitely advantageous to have that design background. And what I think we're seeing more of are people with design and UX backgrounds becoming product managers in those types of contexts because leadership is recognizing, oh, that's a perspective that actually helps us deliver better product as long as those design leaders also understand the technical and business underpinnings.
Yeah. What does that becoming look like? Is it just like you update, you know, like I used to joke, like, you know, step one is to update your LinkedIn profile, right? Like, you know, but like, you know, it's definitely a trend I'm seeing, that people who like, who definitely, they have a lot of components that would make them what in like 2007 we would have called like a UX designer. They've got like, you know, good empathy and, you know, reasonably decent abilities to research things and chase things down. What's the bit that they add to that that makes them product manager?
Yeah, I think the bit that they add to that that makes a designer a product manager is a recognition that design isn't the end-all be-all of the work to be done. There's a recognition and an appreciation for understanding the business context in which the design work is happening, an engagement with the technical capabilities and constraints, which not every designer has that interest. Right, a lot of designers love the craft of design and want to do design, and that's great. But then you find other designers who tend to think a little more systemically, yeah, and feel that their designs are better when they understand the business and technical constraints. And those designers tend to be the ones who then, yeah, become product managers, because they're already kind of operating in that mode. It doesn't necessarily even have to be like a formal distinction at Groupon. I hired a old school UX guy with very similar amount of experience as I had as a design manager for a team. And as an old school UX guy, I mean, this was true when I was working at Studio Archetype in 97, 98. You know, you worried about technical constraints, you tried to understand the business challenges, right? You were sitting, those were all factors that, yeah, that informed your design work. And that's how this guy continued to practice, to the degree which I had a meeting with a product manager who was working with that team, not mm-hmm. as part of that team. And he thought this design lead was the product manager for that product, because the product manager, I don't want to say was incompetent, but was basically a technical manager.
Yeah.
Groupon had a philosophy of hiring CS backgrounded product managers because they saw product management largely as engineering management.
Right.
And that is a strain that pretty much started with Google and you see in a lot of places. The problem is when you're trying to create a product for a consumer audience, that doesn't get you that far. Yeah. And so this guy appreciated, you know, those concerns, but brought other things to the table and was basically driving feature prioritization, driving the roadmap, having the conversations with engineering and other product managers and other designers to make sure it was all going, having conversations with other like product managers outside of his team to make sure they knew what was going on. So he was acting like a product manager. It just happened he was the design lead and he was just filling a gap.
Right.
That work wasn't being done. So he's like, well, I can do it, so I'll do it. And it turned out, by any other name, that was product management. And I think that's how a lot of designers find themselves in product management roles, is they do it without realizing it. It's just, it's something that needed to get done.
Yeah.
And people are like, hey, that's kind of like product management. Oh. Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, you know, the trait there seems to be like an excessive amount of curiosity, as in, like, if you're not satisfied with, like, decoupling, like, you know, as in you hand over your Photoshop files or your wireframe, and some people are like, you know, onto the next one. Like, I want to go back and keep designing. That's what I do. Other people are like, what happens now?
And
like, you know, all those forms I designed, or those screens I designed, or that mobile flow, did that work? How's it performing? What do people think of it? I think if you have that like drive of curiosity, you end up either ruffling feathers or becoming a product manager.
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think it's a characteristic that you find among people who, at least historically, kind of gravitated towards that UX design title, because they're interested in use, they're interested in closing that loop, and oftentimes are frankly less interested in design craft. And I'm speaking kind of from my own personal experience and mindset, right? Design is a means to solving a problem. And that problem is delivering some experience, getting some engagement, solving some problem in the world. And you want to know, did it work? You're paying attention to a different set of concerns. Yeah. And you might not be going as deep on design craft, and you might not be, you know, Wilson Minor or Mike Mattis just delivering things that are beautiful and amazing.
Yeah.
But What you are delivering, you're making sure is getting better and better with every successive generation, is delivering on whatever the value was that had been identified.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. One thing I then wonder is, like, if you take a, like, you know, take a startup, like, you know, a couple of people in a garage type startup, is the role of product management, like, paired with, like, entrepreneurship, or does it exist before the product exists?
I think it could, right? I mean, product management, so I'm not thinking about it from the garage startup mentality, right? But, like, we've been talking a lot about process here at Jawbone. I'm part of this, like, little ad hoc committee trying to think about how we can work as project teams better. We tend to be a little more functionally organized, you know, designers, engineers, product managers, and then we have a project, a program, and we pull designers and engineers on it, they work on it, and then they move on to some other thing. And we're trying to move away from that model to one where the same designers and engineers continue to work together on a program over time. It's not rocket science, but it's something we're evolving into. And I think for us, the challenge, and I think this might actually be interesting for your audience, the challenge is evolving from a hardware company to a software company. Because on hardware, you can do that. Once you ship a product, it's literally shipped out the door, in boxes, on shelves, and you do move on to the next thing. You don't iterate necessarily. I mean, you might do the next generation of it, but you kind of, there is a starting over that happens. And the challenge here is, how do you take, you know, is moving away from that hardware driven product management mindset towards a software driven one that is going to be more agile, that is going to be more iterative, that is going to, that warrants, that's never done. Launch, ship slash launch is the beginning, not the end. Whereas in hardware, ship is the end. And so in that kind of model, to answer your question about, does product management happen before the product begins? Potentially, right? A product manager working with a designer and engineer, we've been borrowing from Spotify. If you've dug into the what Spotify's written about product management, and they have the Dream It, Think It, Build It model, and that Dream It model, where you don't have anything, you know, product management can definitely play a role there in helping shape whatever that initial idea is. And there's no product; it's an idea. So, the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
It kind of depends on, again, how you define product management. One of the key things that I think is part of product management that often wasn't considered, even before you necessarily identify a business case and understand how this is going to generate revenue, et cetera, there's an experience strategy that you want to develop that can help you figure out just what that thing is that you're going to try to build a business case against. And that's, again, where I think folks from user experience backgrounds have been developing experience strategies, not realizing that in doing so, they were doing product management because it wasn't seen as part of that. Product management was about business strategy and maybe a technical strategy married together. Well, it turns out it also needs to have that experience strategy in order to be complete.
An interesting part of it, I just realized that the shift from hardware to software is, like, hardware has that sort of shrink wrap software like tendency to it. That once it leaves the building, it's really you can't really afford to get it wrong too many times.
Right.
Unlike software, where you can, like, use lean or agile as effectively as, like, you know, as escape routes, right?
Right.
Do you think that what's your take on this? You have to get it, because you have to get it right when it's hardware, you can probably justify yourself more research, more upfront thinking, thought, consideration,
right,
more attempts before you go into manufacturing. The lean or the agile world would have you ship a lot quicker, make a lot more mistakes, possibly, like, you know, spoil your reputation a lot earlier. Have you, as you see that shift happening here, like, are people here, like, excited about going, like, oh sweet, now we're agile, we can make mistakes, or are you carrying the same discipline that you had when it was, like, you know, hardware?
Yeah, we're bringing some of that hardware discipline in, and it's one of the things that I really appreciate working here, is a recognition of the value of that early exploratory work to figure out why you're doing something and what you should do before you start executing against it. And it's born of that hardware practice where, because of the risk involved in the money that you're going to commit to, you know, spinning up a factory and shipping hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of units of something, you want to mitigate that risk through lots of exploration and pre-shipping iteration. When it comes to software, we're doing some of that. Now, like, you know, and I've spoken about this publicly, I'm not a fan of ship early, ship often, just for its own sake, which I think is kind of how people think about it, right? I have an idea, let's get something out the door in a week, see what people think of that idea, and then iterate in public. Yeah. I still think there's more value to be iterating in a prototyping internal mode when you can iterate more quickly and you're still feeling your way forward, than trying to ship something sooner and iterate in public. The way I tend to talk about it is, with, you know, a lean model, you can ship your first build sooner, but it will take you longer to ship the right build than one where you've done some of that work up front before you did that first ship, but you really nailed in what it is that you are trying to put out in the world. And there's a balance to be struck. You know, it's a failing if you spend too much time in that earlier kind of definition phase, exploring ideas and concepts. The market can move before you're done. And so I think that's kind of born of experience, trying to figure out, okay, how much time do we spend exploring ideas before we then start executing against it? You're going to get it wrong at first, and then kind of figure out your own cadence. But we do that upfront work, that upfront research, that early exploration and concepting before we ship stuff. And folks are happy to do that. They don't want to just like ship things for the sake of it. Yeah. Especially because we do a lot of work in mobile design, which is, you know, that's our primary platform is native, iOS and Android. And it's a pain in the ass to iterate. It's web is way easier to be lean on than mobile for any number of reasons. And so you want to feel pretty good about what you're putting out in the market when you're mobile native first.
Yeah, I'm not even convinced personally that it makes that much sense in web anyway. Like I think genuinely like there's a lot of this has got to do with like how your product might end up, what your go-to-market plan is. Like, if you're hoping your product's going to go viral and you roll the shit up, it's not going to go viral. And you've also burnt your launch news story, and every single chance you had to get people to look at you, you've basically spoiled.
Right.
You're like, if you're in the app store, you're gonna have a 1-star rating or maybe a 3-star rating, but you're not going to be like, hey, this thing is hot, let's try it. So I think people assume you get like 15 chances to launch, but you really don't. Like, you know, like how many times am I going to try out the latest, you know, fitness tracking app from somebody?
Right.
I'll try it once and I'm not particularly impressed. I'm going to be like, okay, you were doing well to get one try out of me. You're not going to get a second one next week because the team had another idea.
Right. You, at most, you'll move on to a different app if you're still interested in the space. But yes, once you have a bad experience, you know, I remember when Path launched, everyone was very excited about it. I played with it. It didn't make any sense to me. I didn't play with it. Yeah. They basically recognized that they had messed up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at some point did a 2.0 that I didn't play with for the longest time, but eventually people I knew started using it. And I, like, years later came back, but whatever goodwill they had built and interest in Buzz, you know, as I think we still see, they haven't really been able to capture that.
Totally. Right? And also, like, I'm not, you know, the other part of, like, the other piece I'm puzzled by is the idea that there's, like, somehow value in me installing your app and deleting it within a week. Like, that you're going to get massive, like, great feedback from that. Like, you're going to get a couple of usage points. Maybe if you've got your analytics really good, you'll know I went over to the friends tab and I came back, and I went over to the updates tab and I came back, and then I closed and I deleted the product.
Now
we know what to do next. You know, I'm not convinced that like the mad insight is there, or at least I'm convinced you could surely replicate such insight in-house without launching, you know. All right, let's maybe talk a little bit about team structure, which is a topic you spoke about Yeah. So one key point from your talk was, you know, you were talking about how design gets located in a software team, and you know, the most, like, I think you know, we've in Intercom we've gone from, like, you know, 4 through 16, we're now like 100, and we've had different versions of this.
100 total in the company.
100 total in the company. Okay. And I guess, like, there was definitely design as a unit, as in, like, talk to the designers, you know, and that was when we had, like, one or two designers. And then there's design as part of each team, so there's a designer in each team. You spoke about the sort of pros and cons of each of them, and you proposed design as a centralized partnership. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, and the centralized partnership is kind of where I landed in my work at Groupon, and I coined that term. I'm sure I'm not the first to realize that form of organization, but I see it as an evolution of how design teams within companies work. Initially, so back when I started doing this type of stuff 20 years ago, at least in enterprises, design teams were essentially internal services firms, right?
Yeah.
If your company had a design team, which most didn't, you know, if they would outsource design, that's why there were so many design agencies. But if you had an internal design team, they basically were as if you had an agency internally, and they would work on projects as they came up, and they kind of, people, designers get farmed out to execute on a project, and then they come back to the centralized design team and then wait for the next project, right, and get farmed out again. And it could even be like an agency, in that there'd be a chargeback model with that, right? You'd understand cost centers,
yeah,
and kind of what are these different business units paying for design. And the problem with that model is that really reduces design to this execution function. Make it pretty. All the hard problems have been kind of figured out. All the major decisions have been decided upon. We now need someone to make it pretty, put it up, make it on brand, etc.
Yeah.
And a good designer coming in even late into a process like that, as they're building something, will probably recognize problems in what it is that they're designing, problems that had already theoretically been decided, and might try to push on those. But because that designer doesn't really have skin in the game, they're not part of that team, they're not seen as committed or dedicated to it, it would be easy for whatever that part of the business is to just dismiss the designer's concerns and contribution. So that's one model. Then, as design is being taken more seriously, particularly in Silicon Valley kind of contexts, tech companies, these types of digital product companies, what's happened is that design has become embedded in these product teams, right? So it's not a centralized internal services firm. It's embedded in all these product teams, or feature teams, as the case may be. So, for example, what I use in my talk is this idea of an e-commerce experience, right? And you'll have a product or feature team dedicated to search and browse, and another one dedicated to the product page, and another one dedicated to reviews, and another one dedicated to the checkout flow. Yeah. And those teams will have 3, 4, 5, 6 engineers, usually one product manager, and one designer. And the good thing about that model, by decentralizing and embedding, is that you now have a designer on that team, dedicated to that team. That team respects the contributions of the designer, and the designer is there all the way through the development process. The problem with that model, though, is that the designer is working on their own, usually not coordinating with the other designers. They're the people they work with most are non-designers, people who don't understand them, don't think like they do, don't speak the same professional language. They get lonely. I've heard that from folks throughout my career who found themselves in this environment, and the experience will fracture because these designers are solving problems in isolation from each other, and they might be doing a good job if you could isolate that feature, but when you pull all these features together, you start running into problems. They don't really weave together appropriately. And so that model wasn't going to work for me as I was organizing the team at Groupon, because I needed a coherent experience across all those features. It's the same shopper going through all these features, and I didn't want anything to get in the way.
From the shopper's perspective, does it feel like, is the knock-on effect that, like, you're going through subtly or maybe obviously different eras of design, of different design skills?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's what happens. I don't know how conscious the shoppers are of it. When I give this talk, I don't actually use a commerce example. Yeah. I use Facebook. And I haven't done it recently, a year or so ago, though. I basically clicked on the left-hand nav from your Facebook newsfeed homepage. And, you know, so you click into photos, you click into Messenger, you click into apps, whatever it is. And each of those products within Facebook is, apart from the blue and Arial, totally different in its design. Some have left-hand navigation. Some have top navigation. The orientation of what's in the middle is different, and kind of how you interact with it. Like, there's no systemic
cohesion,
and that could be okay for Facebook. That, you know, if they're approaching themselves as a portfolio of products that people are maybe dipping into one or two by and large and ignoring the rest, that could be okay. In an experience like Groupon's or any e-commerce where you're leading people through a flow very purposefully, you have to make sure that is coherent. And so the organizational model that I hit upon, you know, that I call the centralized partnership, is trying to have the best of both worlds. So the whole design team was centralized under me as the head of design. And when I started, there were about 30. When I left, there were about 60. Those 60 people were broken up into roughly 10 teams. So, you know, anywhere from 5, 6, 7 folks per those teams, some smaller, some bigger. And but those teams were dedicated to specific parts of the product, right? So I had a consumer platform team. And those people worked on, kind of like what I was explaining with respect to the e-commerce, they worked on anything that every Groupon user would touch. Whereas we had lines of business, right? We had the local line of business that's about the daily deals and kind of going, you know, restaurants and spas and all that stuff. We had the goods business, which is more traditional e-commerce business, and then the getaways, which was a travel business, right? And so those lines of business had dedicated design teams as well, because there's things that are specific to them.
Yeah.
And then this platform business was responsible, though, for the stuff that is common to everyone. And there was a set of product teams that worked on stuff that we determined as platform, like what we call funnel optimization, which was essentially the checkout flow, stuff like that. And so the best of both worlds meant this team of 6 or 7 people was consistently working against these 6 or 7 products.
Right.
They would never work on... these 6 or 7 platform people would never work on a getaways product team like that. We wouldn't cross those lines.
Yeah.
So you had that degree of commitment and engagement that you want from the embedded designer, you know, people who understand the full life cycle of that part of the product and are deeply wedded to it. But by being part of a team, by not embedding someone in the funnel optimization team and someone in the user-generated content team and someone in the personalization team who weren't talking to each other, by being one order above that, we ensured that there was consistency across those product teams. The design team basically had, and this was intentional, talking, you know, I would talk to my boss, who was the head of product, about this, right? The product teams were meant to be these autonomous forces kind of pulling in all directions as they saw fit. And then the design team was this counterbalance that was meant to kind of cohere that effort and make sure it wasn't going off in too chaotic and too fractured a mode. So that was the centralized partnership. Key to making that work is design leadership. You know, I was a VP, 20 years experience. I inherited, we'll remove the communication design and user research teams because I had those reporting up to me. But if we're focused on product design, I inherited what felt like this pile of 13 product designers that are all in their mid-20s and who are just kind of pinging around the organization like pinballs.
Right.
And so what I spent my first 9 months, you know, much of my first 9 months doing when it came to recruiting and hiring was finding design managers and design directors that I could form these teams around. You could form a platform team around, form a local team around, form a goods team around, a getaways team around, and start providing shape. And before we hit record, we were talking about kind of managing up and managing down. These design directors, they became this kind of crucial leverage point within not just design, but within the organization, because through them, they would manage down and get the most out of the team, manage across and work with cross-functionally with the director of product management and director of engineering, and manage up and make sure the executives and stakeholders, you know, those senior stakeholders understood what was going on. And that managing across was perhaps the most important, because before I had that those leaders, I would have a 25-year-old product designer talking to a 35-year-old product manager, right, with 10, 15 years experience, maybe an MBA, and then some dude who's, you know, a hotshot designer, but not a lot of experience, not a lot of gravitas to bring to certain conversations. And that doesn't, I don't know if this is the fair analogy, but it basically led to an unfair fight, right? Where the designer would just basically do what the product manager said because they didn't have the ability to meaningfully push back. By bringing in design leadership who could engage them more as those product managers as peers, that allowed us to drive design thinking back into the product more actively.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Like, in terms of the consumer platform team there, like, did they own like a sort of pattern library for all of the and like that was their property?
That was their property. That was one of the key things that they owned. Was we called it the GIG for Groupon Interface Guidelines, but you can imagine it as it's like Twitter Bootstrap,
right?
A library of design patterns and code snippets and all that stuff, so that those could ideally be farmed out to all these different teams. I considered them. The analogy is a little bit flawed, but I basically considered them, the platform team manufactured the Legos, and then the other design teams would build, put together those Legos to create whatever they needed. And sometimes they would have a special problem, and there were two ways to solve that. They either fixed it themselves and submitted that back to this kind of platform team that also ended up serving almost in a, like that open source model, like that's approved or not approved, or like that's, that is canon or not. Or they would go to that to the platform team and say, "Hey, we need a widget that does blah. Can you spin one up or whatever it is?" So,
And like, is the the knock on effect of that transition sounds like you'd go from like a load of like, you know, what I saw referred to before as like the Las Vegas Strip problem, which was the idea being that, like, you know, multiple conflicting calls to action by everyone doing their own thing, looking out for their own part of the product, if you like. Is the consumer platform team kind of like a, you know, a moderator of all this? Like, who ensures that, like, that different products don't fight for attention within?
Yeah, and so that ensuring of kind of coherence and cohesion, and that it's not this Las Vegas kind of light up crap show. That would happen. That's another place where leadership, design leadership, was important. I had, you know, a head of platform design, a head of locals design, a head of goods design, a head of getaways design. The four of them were responsible for the entire consumer experience, right? Yeah. The shopper-facing part of Groupon could be managed by a conversation of four people.
Right.
That's all it took. Because through those four people, you had all the design happening that faced consumers. You couldn't get that same number of product managers in a room and have a meaningful conversation. You need way more, and engineering leads even more, right? One of the things that I realized at Groupon is, and we've talked a little bit about designer-developer ratios before we hit record, is you need way few designers compared to any other role. Maybe not product manager, but definitely to the engineering roles and all the attendant engineering roles of QA and analytics. And we have data science and BI and all that kind of stuff, right? You only need a few designers, and those designers become this point of leverage. And so to answer your, going back to answering that question, three or four design directors can meet once a week, check in on each other, and make sure they're not making life miserable for the consumer. And then go back to doing what they're doing, right? It doesn't have to be this big, overwhelming kind of exercise. So, that was how it was handled.
That sounds pretty smart. I mean, one thing that we certainly found in the shift, and I'm sure you we saw traits of this, is the pull for us away from having like design as a distinct group of people that we could call on when needed, like David said, like some sort of bat phone, and you're like, hey, we need design on this thing. What we ended up with, and what I've seen, you know, other companies still struggle with, is like some sense of like what I call like, you know, design amnesia. So like every time you come to a part of the product, you're like, this is the first time you're seeing it, or like you saw you did see it before, but it was 11 months ago, and the whole thing has changed because there's been three other designers on it since then. And what you lack is kind of like domain expertise and a kind of long term vision. It sounds like the design partnership, the centralized partnership, kind of you get kind of, you know, the benefits of both design on demand, but also you get like long term, you get, I guess, long term depth of knowledge, right?
Right. You definitely get the long term depth of knowledge. You don't necessarily get design on demand. Like, there would be parts of the, and this was a problem, this is actually one of the challenges with this model, there'd be parts of the organization that would ask for design, and we didn't have any ability to give it to them,
right?
Because we were understaffed or whatever at the time, but wasn't the priority. And it's the challenge with this model, because if you buy into a centralized design function that is committed to serving the rest of the organization, instead of embedding designers within each of these product teams, what you have done is you have taken power and an ability to be the masters of their own future away from these product teams, right? You like, we did expressly deny people's ability to hire designers. I even once had a product manager or product team say, we will give you a headcount for a designer, but that designer has to be able to work for us. And I'm like, no, that can't be how it is, right? And it's hard on these product teams that are otherwise being told, you're autonomous, be free, go do what you want, to have this key function that they don't have control over. And it's I think ultimately it's a good tension to have, and I think it ultimately leads to better product, but it does create a tension, and it requires a different way of design teams communicating with these product managers, essentially, and making sure that the designers are getting way out ahead and understanding where product managers are going, and making sure that they're ready to address that. And if it means, okay, we need to open some recs to make sure that we are staffed enough across, to support all of these initiatives. Or if we think that there are maybe efficiencies to be realized or commonalities across different parts of the product experience, and maybe that's a way to solve that problem. But it does provide a challenge. It isn't design on demand. It's not that you turn on a spigot and design starts flowing out, then you can turn it off. It's not that straightforward. For many parts of the organization, it is.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, it not every, you know, you can't serve all the people all the time.
Yeah, of course. Right.
So
speaking of on demand, maybe our last topic. There is an industry that does design on demand that you could call agencies.
Right.
And you've had various thoughts about the future of in-house, and you've cited how it's certainly true that some of the signature top name design agencies have seem to have been like shrinking in their numbers.
Or evaporating altogether.
Or evaporating into the actual ether.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
What's happened is companies have recognized a different order of the value of design. You know, to the degree to which businesses understood design and the value of design earlier, it was from an execution function, it was to stay on brand, it was to be appealing, to be stylish, to differentiate yourself, but it wasn't as a key strategic contributor to whatever it is that business is doing. With the ascendancy of Apple, and a bunch of other factors as well, that has changed, where businesses have begun to realize design is a core competency for any business that has customers, i.e. any business, and that design delivers a type of value different than other functions we're delivering. And so they're all building in-house design teams.
Right.
And so that ends up having a couple of pressures on agencies. Agencies are now not competing just with other agencies for talent. They're competing with these in-house design teams for talent. And one of the things that, at least in the specific to the San Francisco Bay Area, In-house design teams can afford to pay designers way more than agencies can. Economics, that's just how it works out. As I understand it, that is not true in many other geographies, but that is definitely true here. What is true regardless of geography, though, is that a company that might have a design budget, and maybe has had a design budget for a while, that used to outsource most of that spend, you know, 80% outsourced with the 20% internal to kind of manage those relationships, that is now flipped, where the budget is 80% internal, we're building a team, we're staffing up this capability, 20% outsource. Even if the and that might be true, even and the budget for design could double in that case, right? If you're following me with the math there. And that's still way less money to spend on design than they used to have.
Right.
And so the challenges that design firms are facing is that the size of projects, the client's willingness to spend has flatlined and even declined as they're doing more internal investing in design because they just don't have as much money now to spend externally. And so in San Francisco in particular, you're getting squeezed by both of these forces. And it makes it that much harder to sustain a design agency. That seems to be what's going on in terms of that shift.
Is there any, so that makes total sense, especially at the point about salaries, I hadn't considered as being like so raw in its impact, but it is just true that the necessary markup and like downtime a consultancy is going to face has to be dealt with, and clients pay that. And then that is also, clients could also just pay that as a salary differentiator and, you know, have the designer.
In the Silicon Valley, you know, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, you know, originally Google and then now Facebook have just decided to throw giant sums of money at designers. They probably are doing it at engineers as well. And because both of these are machines that generate enormous profits, they have totally changed the hiring market for design, where us here at Jawbone, a pre-IPO 15-year-old startup, have to pay. We're not going to offer Facebook and Google salaries. We can't get quite there, but we have to pay something closer to that. And it's just everyone is paying more. And if you're venture funded and have enough of that money, you can afford to do it. You know, design firms that are pay for themselves through the profits generated by the work, the economics doesn't work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, another design firm got acquired by a bank just about a month ago. I have a friend who has a small design firm, and I haven't heard the details, but I found out that they just laid off their whole design staff.
Right.
It's a much harder business to run.
Is there one other thing going on? Like, has the nature of the work changed? I mean, I'm thinking, like, I worked in a design consultancy in, like, 2006, 2010 or so, and certainly, like, I participated in a lot of practices that I don't see happening in companies like when you have a full design in-house. I'm talking about things like everything from like sketching workshops to like persona generation to storyboards, that sort of stuff. Do you think does the work of an in-house team, is it in any way different to the work of what an agency would do in its place?
Not necessarily. I actually think, so this is one of those things where I think there are things that in-house teams, particularly in-house kind of Silicon Valley product tech teams, could learn from agency work and have either chosen to ignore or didn't know about. I actually think there are things from agency practice, such as user research and personas and prototyping and visions and sketch workshops and all that, that could make in-house design better. But in-house design can get so caught up in ship that it loses sight of that ability to pull back and frame the problem, not just try to solve the problem. So I don't necessarily see that as that fundamental a difference. Now, kind of depends on the agency. There's this flavor of design agency for every type of design. At Adaptive Path, at least while I was there, it had definitely been shifting much more towards a kind of strategic design consulting. What's interesting about that now is you're starting to see I mean, we just hired a woman who was working at Fjord that had been acquired by Accenture. McKinsey is spinning up an internal design practice. I just talked to someone who works at Boston Consulting Group's digital design practice. So these big management consulting firms have all caught design religion and are building out design practices. And I'm sure they are charging 2 to 3 times for those for that exact same design work that your consultancy was doing, that Adaptive Path was doing. But they're now applying it in a different mode, doing it top down. And they're doing that. I mean, they're doing the Lord's work from a design standpoint in terms of influencing like the highest level of strategy within these organizations. So I actually think some of it's gone way upstream in that regard. And then the more kind of execution-oriented design work, the challenge that agencies are facing is it's not just about a boatload of wireframes and then a boatload of mocks and shipping that to someone. And there are smaller, nimbler agencies. I recently did a podcast interview with some friends of mine who have a small consultancy in Austin called Funsize. And they've had to, they basically approach agency design as in an agile way, right? They do 2 week sprints. They're working side by side with their clients, which is not at all how I worked in a design firm before. But if you're on that end where you're helping people execute and ship, those design agencies are having to change how they work and the relationships they have with their clients. And so you're seeing this kind of bifurcation happen, I think, from an agency standpoint, where you're either going way upstream or you're in the trenches. Yeah. And whatever that middle thing was, that's kind of what's evaporated. And maybe what's kind of gone in-house to some degree, kind of to the degree to which there is some kind of strategic design work happening that's happening now in-house.
It's interesting how, like, you know, you could say, like, the before we had, like, full-stack design agencies, like strategy all the way down to Photoshop. And it seems to have like cracked in half. Like strategy has gone to the people who are consulted first and foremost for strategy, the McKinsey's, Accenture's, whatever. And then the bottom half has gone like to the, you know, has been specialized around literally plugging into other companies to be executors. So an agency that can kind of do the full spectrum can neither charge for it nor hire for it, basically.
Having a harder time. The one exception seems to be what still remains of digital marketing agencies, interactive marketing agencies, your RGAs and AKQAs, those types of companies are delivering on that fuller spectrum. Even someone like Frog is trying to deliver on that fuller spectrum. But I think there's fewer and fewer of those organizations, and it's because there's fewer and fewer clients who are willing to turn over what is essentially running their business to someone outside of their company.
That makes sense. You've been very generous with your time, so I'll stop here. Thank you so much for your time, Peter.
My pleasure. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Inside Intercom podcast. If you like what you've heard, subscribe on SoundCloud to automatically receive new episodes.